pointed to a canoe on the beach. "Keoki," he reasoned quietly. "Surely you must know that a canoe like that could not carry 58 people for 30 days, all the way from Tahiti." Keoki moved so that he could see the broad, silvery passageway that lay between Lanai Island and Kahoolawe, leading south. "Reverend Hale, do you recall the name of that stretch of water?"
"Don't they call it Kealaʻi Kahiki?" Abner replied.
"And have you ever heard the name of that point at Kahoolawe?"
"No."
"It's likewise Kealaʻi Kahiki Point." "What do you suppose Kealaʻi Kahiki means?"
"Well," Abner reflected,
"Ke means the, ala means road, I means to, and I don't know what Kahiki means."
"You know that what we call K, the people to the south call T. Now, what does Kahiki mean?"
Against his will, Abner formed the older word of which Kahiki was a late corruption.
"Tahiti," he whispered. "The way to Tahiti."
"Yes," Keoki said. "If you sail from Lahaina, pass through Kealaʻi Kahiki Strait, and take your heading from Kealaʻi Kahiki Point, you will reach Tahiti. My ancestors often sailed that way. In canoes." And the proud young man was gone. But Abner refused to accept such claims, and by consulting many Hawaiians, he proved to his satisfaction that the word Kahiki meant not Tahiti, but any distant place. So he added his own note to the Yale manuscript. "Kealaʻi Kahiki may be translated as the path to far places or the beyond." Then, as if to prove that Abner was right, the Hawaiian captain of Kelolo's ship Thetis got drunk, stayed in his cabin during a storm, and allowed his sturdy old veteran of many seas to climb upon the rocks off Lahaina, where it rotted through the years, a visible proof that Hawaiians could not even navigate in their own waters, let alone penetrate distant oceans. It was while Abner was drafting a letter to Honolulu, advising the mission board that his assistant Keoki Kanakoa was behaving strangely, so that perhaps the board ought to consider Keoki's reassignment to some post of lesser importance, that the news was shouted through the still morning air that was to disrupt Lahaina for many days. Pupali's oldest daughter came screaming to Jerusha's school, "Iliki, Iliki, it has arrived, the Carthaginian." And before the startled Jerusha could intercede, the bright-eyed beauty had leaped over the bench and dashed madly away with her sister. Together, they swam out to the sleek whaler, with the dark sides and the white stripe running lengthwise, where naked and shimmering in the sunlight, they were both gathered into the arms of the bark's tall captain and led below to his quarters, from which he shouted, "Mr. Wilson, I don't want to be interrupted till tomorrow morning, not even for food." But he was interrupted. Kelolo dispatched three policemen to the Carthaginian under orders to drag Pupali's daughters off to jail. But when they climbed aboard the whaler, Mr. Wilson met them on the afterdeck, shouting, "Get away, I'm warning you." "We come fetch vahinis," the officers explained. "You'll get broken jaws," Mr. Wilson threatened. Whereupon one of the policemen shoved out his elbows, knocked the first mate aside, and started for the after hatchway. Mr. Wilson, thrown off balance for a moment, tried to lunge at the intruder. But another of the policemen grabbed him, which became the signal for a general scuffle, in which, because most of the men were ashore, the three rugged policemen appeared to be winning. "What the hell's going on here?" came a roar from the lower deck, followed by a lithe form, tall and muscular, leaping up the ladder. Captain Hawksworth was dressed only in a pair of tight sailor's pants, and when he saw what was happening on his ship, he lowered his head, lunged at the first policeman, and shouted, "Into the ocean with him!" The agile officer saw Hawksworth coming, sidestepped with agility, and brought his right forearm viciously across the back of the captain's neck,
sending him sprawling across the deck, where the New Englander cut his lower lip on his own teeth. Wiping the blood onto the back of his hand, Hawksworth glimpsed the red stain, and from his knees cried ominously, "All right." Rising slowly, testing his bare feet on the decking, Hawksworth moved cautiously toward the policeman who had poleaxed him. With a deceptive lunge to the right, followed by a snake-like twist to the left, Hawksworth brought his powerful right fist into the policeman's face. Then, with the Hawaiian's head momentarily snapped back, Hawksworth doubled up his own head and shoulders and drove into the man's stomach like a battering ram. The surprised policeman staggered backward and fell onto the deck, whereupon Hawksworth began kicking viciously at his face. But remembering from the pain in his bare feet as they crashed into the man's head that he wore no shoes, he quickly grabbed a belaying pin and started to thrash the fallen islander, thundering solid blows onto the man's head and crotch until the policeman fainted. Still, Hawksworth continued hammering him until sounds from other parts of the deck called him to activity there. Brandishing his brutal pin, he whipped about to help Mr. Wilson, who was having a bad time with a large policeman, until Captain Hawksworth brought down with all the force in his bare arms the rugged belaying pin across the man's skull. The big islander fell instantly, and Hawksworth instinctively kicked him in the face, then set off for the third officer. But this man, having witnessed Hawksworth's savage attacks upon his mates, prudently abandoned the battle and leaped into the bay. With a well-directed throw, Hawksworth spun the belaying pin through the air and caught the man in the face, cutting open a huge gash across his forehead. At once, the man sank below the waves, leaving a patch of purple where he had gone down, and one of Hawksworth's sailors shouted, "He's drowning." "Let the bastard drown," Hawksworth shouted violently, "and let these swine join him." Alone, he picked up the first unconscious victim, strained as the man's feet slowly cleared the railing, and then, with a mighty heave, tossed the policeman toward the general direction of the first, who had now dazedly regained the surface in time to help his battered and inert companion. Now Hawksworth grabbed the feet of the third policeman and Mr. Wilson the hands, and with a 1, 2, 3 prepared to toss him overboard. But one of the man's hands was bloody, and on the three count Mr. Wilson lost his grip, so that when Hawksworth threw the legs mightily over the railing, the first mate failed to do so with the hands, and the policeman's face struck the wood with great force, breaking his jaw and cheekbones before he pitched into the bay. There he floated for a moment, then dropped slowly to the bottom, from which he was recovered a day later. "I'm afraid he's drowned," Mr. Wilson said apprehensively. "Let him drown," Hawksworth growled, licking his damaged lip. Then, grabbing a horn, he shouted ashore, "Don't anybody try to board this ship, now or ever." Tossing the horn to his mate, he brushed off his sweating chest, stamped his bare feet to knock away the pain, and growled at Mr. Wilson, "I was disgusted with your performance." "I stood them off one after the other," the mate protested. "You fought all right," Hawksworth admitted grudgingly, "but you had stout shoes on, and when I had the bastards down, you didn't kick him in the face." "It didn't occur to me," Mr. Wilson began apologetically. Quickly, furiously, Captain Hawksworth grabbed his mate by the jacket. When you fight a man aboard ship and he knows he's licked, always kick him in the face, because forever after, when he looks in a mirror, he'll have to remember. If you let him go without scarring him, sooner or later he begins to think, "Hawksworth wasn't so dangerous. Next time I'll thrash him." But if he constantly sees the memory of solid leather across his jawbone, he can't fool himself. Seeing that his mate was shaken by this advice, he pushed him away and added coldly, "Keeping control of a ship is difficult duty, Mr. Wilson, and until you nerve yourself to it, you'll never be a captain." Abruptly, he swung himself down the after ladder, shouting, "This time I don't want to be disturbed." And he rejoined Pupali's daughters. Ashore, there was consternation. On the one hand, Kelolo was appalled that Americans would dare to kill one of his policemen in sight of the entire community, and he hurried to Malama to ask her what ought to be done. She was suffering from major ills and lay back on the floor, wheezing in the day's heat. But when she heard Kelolo's ominous report, she called her attendants and with real effort rose and dressed. Then, with her two ladies-in-waiting, she went into the town, and after assembling all available policemen, she proceeded to the pier. On the other hand, the various ship's captains who had been chafing futilely against the new laws saw in Hawksworth's bold action a chance to re-establish their control over Lahaina and to restore the good old days. Accordingly, they too assembled at the pier and passed the word to their men. If they try to arrest Captain Hawksworth, we'll all fight. And as the sailors gathered, they armed themselves with stones and, where possible, with substantial clubs. Malama pointed to the Carthaginian and said quietly, "Kelolo, arrest that captain." Obediently, though with some apprehension, Kelolo adjusted his policeman's cap, picked three unwilling helpers, tested his two muskets, and set out for the whaler. But he had gone less than half the distance when Captain Hawksworth, alerted by Mr. Wilson, rushed on deck with a brace of pistols and began firing madly at the rowboat. "Don't you come a foot nearer," he shouted, reloading and blazing away again. This time, the bullets struck perilously close to the boat, and Kelolo did not have to order his men to cease rowing. They did so automatically, stared at the infuriated captain, then quickly retreated. To the surprise of all the watchers, and to the cheers of the sailors, Captain Hawksworth unexpectedly, perhaps even to himself, now swung barefooted over the side of the Carthaginian, one revolver in his left hand, one jammed into the belt of his trousers, and started rowing furiously ashore. The other sea captains formed a reception committee, both to welcome and protect him. Before he had touched shore, he was shouting, "Captain Henderson, is that a cannon I see on the bay tree?" "It is. I'm heading for China." "Got any balls?" "I have." Content, Hawksworth leaped ashore and strode up to Kelolo. Then, seeing Malama in the background, he thrust the police chief aside and stormed over to the Ili'inui. "Ma'am," he growled, "there's not going to be any more interference with the whalers in this port." "The new laws have been announced," Malama said stoutly. "The new laws be goddamned," Hawksworth stormed. The sailors cheered, so he left Malama abruptly and advised them, "Do any goddamn thing you like." The whaling captains applauded, and one cried, "Can we bring whiskey ashore?" "Whiskey, girls, any damn thing you want," Hawksworth roared. Then, seeing Kalolo's two assistants who carried the muskets, he rushed over, ripped the arms from them, and fired twice into the air. At this moment, the crowd separated, and onto the pier stepped Abner Hale, dressed formally in clawhammer and top hat, but still limping slightly from his old wound received at the hands of the blusterer who now threatened Lahaina's peace. Kelolo drew back, as did the bewildered policeman whose arms had been taken from them. "Good morning, Captain Hawksworth," Abner said. The violent whaler stepped back, looked at the little missionary, and laughed. "I threw this miserable little bastard to the sharks once. I'll do it again," he roared. And the captains, all of whom despised Abner as the author of the sumptuary laws, shouted encouragement. "You will send the girl Iliki back to school," Abner said forcefully. The two men stared at each other for a long moment, and then almost unconsciously Captain Hawksworth's real intention in coming to Lahaina manifested itself. He wanted to see Jerusha Bromley. Desperately, driven by powerful memories and dreams of revenge, he wanted to see this brown-haired girl. He lowered his pistols, jammed them back into his pants, and said, "We can talk better at your house." "Shall we bring the whiskey ashore?" one of the captains shouted. Of course, Hawksworth snapped. There are no laws.
We'll meet at Murphy's, the captains yelled.
Where is your house? Hawksworth asked.
There, said Abner, pointing past the taro patch.
For a moment, Captain Hawksworth stared aghast, and in his incredulity, Abner perceived for the first time the really miserable hovel in which he and Jerusha lived.
Does Jerusha live there? Hawksworth gasped, staring at the low grass roof, the rain-tattered walls, and the Dutch doorway.
Yes, Abner replied. Jesus Christ Almighty, man, Hawksworth ejaculated. What's the matter with you?
With huge strides, the barefooted, bare-chested captain strode up the dusty road, kicked open the wooden gate in the high wall, and brushed into the grass house. Standing on the earthen floor, he adjusted his eyes to the darkness, and finally saw, in the doorway that separated the children's quarters from Abner's study, the girl he had wanted to marry. He looked a long time at the tired face, the hair not quite tended, the red hands. He saw the cast-off dress that did not fit, and the coarse shoes also second-hand, a size too large and scuffed from long years in the dust. Possibly because of the darkness, possibly because he did not wish to recognize such things, he did not see the persuasive radiance that shone from Jerusha's tired eyes, nor did he sense the peace that encompassed her.
My God, Jerusha, what has he done to you?
The harsh voice caused one of the children to whimper, and Jerusha left the doorway for a moment, but she soon returned and said,
Sit down, Captain Hawksworth.
Where, for Christ's sake, Hawksworth stormed, beside himself with anger and bitterness. On a box? At a table like this? With extreme violence, he smashed at Abner's rickety table, sending the Bible translations into the wind. Where could I sit down if I wanted to? Jerusha, do you call this a home?
No, the self-possessed woman replied. I call this my temple.
The answer was so final and implied so much that Hawksworth set adrift his first fleet of compassionate thoughts and established in their place an overpowering desire to hurt Jerusha and her husband. Kicking at the fallen table, he laughed.
So this is the Senate from which the laws are handed down?
No, Abner said cautiously, recovering the fallen Bible. This book is.
So you're going to rule Lahaina by the Ten Commandments? Hawksworth asked with a hysterical laugh.
As we rule ourselves, Abner replied.
Again, Hawksworth kicked at the table, bruising his foot as he did so. Does the Bible direct you to live like hogs? Does it say you have to work your wife like a slave?
Impulsively, he grabbed Jerusha's hand and held it aloft as if he were selling her. But patiently, she withdrew it and straightened her dress. Her action infuriated Hawksworth, and he backed away from the missionaries, lashing them horribly with insulting words, towering oaths and threats which he had the capacity to enforce.
All right, you goddamn sniveling little worms. You can pass the laws, but you can't make the fleet keep 'em. Reverend Hale, there's going to be women aboard those whalers by noon.
The women will not be allowed to go, Abner said stubbornly.
My men have been at sea for 9 months, Hawksworth said, and when they reach shore, they're going to have women. All the goddamn black-assed Hawaiian women they want. Me, I always have two, one fat one and one skinny one.
Will you go to the church, Jerusha? Abner asked.
She'll stay here, Hawksworth shouted, grabbing her once more by the hand. Let her hear how a real man lives.
He had a consuming desire to abuse her mind with ugly pictures, to humiliate her.
Now, when I get hold of a fat one and a skinny one, ma'am, I like to lock the door for about 2 days, and I undress completely. That's why you find me only in pants. I was interrupted and had to kill a man. And when I'm undressed, I like to throw myself back on the bed and say to the girls, All right, the first one of you who can...
His explanation was halted by a stinging blow from Abner's open palm against his bruised lip.
He stopped in astonishment, then thrust out his big right arm and caught Abner by the wrist. Turning it until the missionary had to kneel in the dust of his own home, Hawksworth retained his hold on Jerusha and finished. "I tell the two girls that the first one who can make me get hard can climb aboard, and when she does, the other one has to blow on me." Jerusha kneeled in the dust beside her husband, and Rafer Hawksworth looked down with contempt at the two miserable creatures. "What are you doing, Jerusha?" he tormented. "Tending your little man?"
"I am praying for you," Jerusha said in the dust.
Impetuously, Hawksworth threw them both across the room and then stood over them threateningly. "There's a cannon aboard the Bay Tree, and by the guts of God, if there is any interference with the whaling fleet, I'll blow this house to pieces." He started for the open door, but felt compelled to turn and laugh at the fallen missionaries. "You'll be interested to know that of all Pupali's daughters, the young one, Iliki, is the best. Iliki, the pelting spray of the sea. I started with Pupali's wife and worked my way right through his girls, but Iliki is my choice. And do you know why? Because you taught her such nice manners here at the mission. When she climbs on top of me, she says, 'Please.'" When he left, the two missionaries remained on their knees for some minutes praying, and then Jerusha helped her husband rebuild the rickety table and collect his manuscript. Realizing that Captain Hawksworth meant his threats about the cannon, she took her two children over to Amanda Whipple's, but did not divulge the scenes that had taken place at the mission. Then she returned to Abner, desiring to be with him if further trouble developed. It did. The General Whaling Fleet saw in Hawksworth's bold defiance a chance to abolish forever the restrictive laws, and they coursed through Lahaina, tearing, raping, and destroying. They drove policemen into hiding and then congregated at the new fort, where Kelolo and a last group of trusted subordinates were determined to make a stand. "Rip down the fort," sailors who had been jailed there shouted.